This week, mutiny in Moscow. A short-lived uprising by mercenary group Wagner raises questions about Vladimir Putin's grip on power. What are the implications for African countries who rely on Wagner's services and resources? Also, with the BRICS summit just weeks away, will Putin be forced to scrap his travel plans to South Africa? We'll bring you reporting and analysis. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Hello there and a warm welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm Heidi Adams. Russia has experienced the most serious threat to the state in decades when the mercenary group Wagner mutinied. Its leader threatened to remove President Vladimir Putin from power. The episode was brief, lasting fewer than 24 hours, but leaves big questions about Putin's political future. The story, narrated by Jonathan Speer, is from VOA's Moscow Bureau.
Wagner mercenary troops occupied the southern Russian city of Rostov-on-Don on Saturday for about 12 hours, encountering little resistance as they seized the local military headquarters. Now, after an agreement with the Kremlin, they will return to their bases in the territory that Russia occupies in Ukraine, with promises of no retribution. The group's leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, is going into exile in Belarus under the auspices of President Alexander Lukashenko, a Putin ally. The Wagner mutiny threatened the Russian capital and prompted harsh words from Putin against its perpetrators in an address to the nation.
What we're facing is exactly internal betrayal. Extraordinary ambitions and personal interests led to treason. Treason of their own country and people, and of the case that fighters of Wagner were dying for alongside our soldiers.
Russian officials have flooded the media with assurances that Putin emerged stronger from this short crisis. But international observers say, on the contrary, the Russian leader's weaknesses have been irreversibly exposed.
This destroys the myth that Putin had cultivated so hard of being completely in control and having a firm grip on power throughout the country. That is plainly no longer the case. And the Prigozhin incident sets an extremely dangerous precedent for power in Russia. Once other people see that this can be done and it can be survived, there will be other challenges.
Now, the Russian authorities are working to cover up the tracks of the Wagner Group, which until last week was praised by Kremlin propaganda. Prigozhin has challenged Moscow's narrative. Speaking of the precarious situation of the Russian army in Ukraine, one of the reasons why, Prigozhin says, he launched the mutiny.
We have daily losses of up to 1,000 people. This includes those killed, those missing, and those injured, and those who are refusing, who don't want to fight, not because they are cowards, but because they have no choice, no weapons supplies, no command structure.
Observers believe that whatever deal Putin has made with Prigozhin, a dark future awaits the mercenary leader.
Whatever happens for the rest of his life, he'll be a man looking over his shoulder, because he will now be a marked man. He has challenged power in Russia and so far survived. The question is, for how long?
Calm has returned, at least for the moment, to the streets in Russia. But after the acute crisis last weekend, analysts say the events of the last few days may be a precursor to something bigger. For the VOA Moscow Bureau, Jonathan Speer, VOA News.
Well, joining me now to discuss this is Danila Galparovic from VOA's Russia Service. Danila, welcome back to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much for having me.
Please bring us up to speed here. Vladimir Putin still very much in power. Yevgeny Prigozhin in exile. What did this mutiny really tell us about Putin's hold on power? There's been a lot of talk about the cracks are beginning to show. What are the real fault lines here?
It was really serious blow dealt to Putin's image, because whatever Kremlin is telling now to the Russian public through social media and everything else can see that it's not consistent with reality completely, because what we saw in this city, which Prigozhin's mercenaries took under control, the city of Rostov-on-Don, is that public greeted Prigozhin's mercenaries, when they left, they were treated as heroes. People make a round of applause for them. They call them heroes on the record. I mean, they said, come again. And in complete difference, people's mood towards the police, which was kind of, you know, following the Prigozhin's mercenaries, was traitors and so on. So public was quite excited, at least in Rostov-on-Don, about the Prigozhin mercenaries and so on. And this is completely contradicts what Putin is trying to tell Russian public, that the army and the people like resisted the coup and everything else. So it is a great deal of damage for Putin's image, for Putin's grip of power, because everybody is saying now that you can do it. You can go like knife through the butter with a group of mercenaries until up to like 200 kilometers to Moscow, and nobody will stop you, because Wagner Group successfully shut down several helicopters. So I think it is what Kremlin is trying to tell in reality are completely different now.
Now, this being Russia, and I'd be remiss if I did not ask this question, I mean, because war doesn't tend to make leaders do strange things. You talked about reality earlier. How much of this whole saga was real? How much of it was theater? Because, I mean, was any part of this a distraction? Because what are we talking about now? We're talking about the mutiny, and we're not talking about the war in Ukraine.
This is really interesting. The image which your correspondent shown in the beginning, the tank stuck in some gates. It's this tank stuck in the gates of circus. It was a circus in Rostov-on-Don where tanks stacked, actually. And it is a very good image for the explanation of all of this. Tanks stacked in the gates
metaphor.
Of circus.
Right.
Yeah, because it's all more or less reminds us in the previous staged events by Kremlin. And we don't know exactly what's true, what's not. We don't know exactly to what extent Belarusian President Lukashenko is the central figure of this negotiations as he's trying to present himself. Yeah. We don't know in what moment Putin actually called him or Lukashenko called Putin to offer something. We don't know if their explanation is true. So, and of course, it was a distraction from the war in Ukraine, I mean Russian war in Ukraine, Russian aggression in Ukraine, that some troops were moved from the border to the direction of Russian mercenaries coming to the capital. So, as we know now, Ukrainian forces are now in offensive for 4 days in a row. So I remember speaking with General Philip Bridlove, who is the former NATO commander, NATO forces commander in Europe, and he said this is a good opportunity for Ukrainian forces to use, and I believe they somehow used it.
But does this mutiny, I mean, as little as much as we know, does it give us some idea or some window into some sort of dysfunction inside the Kremlin?
Yes, to some extent, Putin liked to be like arbiter over the fighting all the time. He gave some independency to state departments, especially departments of law enforcement, Ministry of Defense, and so on, like do your own money and so on. But it seems that he doesn't control even them now, because we see that two generals, Suravikin and others, had to speak to Prigozhin directly. Like without any statement of the head of state, and Putin appeared on TV screens much, much later than, again, General Suravikin and others tried to persuade Prigozhin to stop. So we don't know exactly to what extent it damaged Putin's control over, like, power structures in Moscow, mm-hmm. but it's definitely showed his weakness. And many of people in Moscow, and it was a direct threat to Moscovites, and many of them are working in the government. So many of them will think, so if he's not that strong, maybe we need to think about somebody else, something else, new structure, anyway, about some changes.
Just final two-part question, actually. Tell us just a little bit about the status of the relationship between Prigozhin and Putin right now? And what are you looking for next now in your reporting?
Nobody knows where Prigozhin is now because Belarusian President Lukashenko, he told reporters that, yes, Prigozhin is in Belarus now, but we saw the plane of Prigozhin moving into Belarus, out of Belarus, and so on. So we don't know where he is now. We don't know what guarantees he received from Kremlin, like to stay alive, to stay safe. It's not clear. It seems that Putin has a very serious grudge against him now because he, every day, the second day in a row, he's explaining how Wagner was financed by the state, how big Prigozhin is as a traitor is, and so on. So, I mean, a reporter of VOA who reported about that, he's completely right about absolutely unclear future for Prigozhin. They are not close anymore, definitely. I mean, now Prigozhin is a traitor, is an enemy, and probably he's doomed.
Well, I saw a wonderful picture of Putin juxtaposed with Prigozhin and a headline reading, "The enemy of our enemy is now our enemy." So thank you so much, Danil Galparovich. He's a correspondent and anchor from VOA's Russian News Service. I do appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Well, now, we ran a poll on Facebook asking our followers the following question. Do you think that the mutiny of the leader of Russia's Wagner Group last week indicates that there are cracks in Russian President Vladimir Putin's grip on power? And here's what our respondents said. 48% of them said yes, 52% of them said no. And of course, a reminder that these polls are not scientific. We were just gauging this from the respondents, those who chose to respond on our Facebook page. Thank you so much. Well, we're going to take a short break here. And when Straight Talk Africa returns, we'll look at the implications of the short-lived mutiny in Moscow for African countries, especially those who have close ties to Vladimir Putin and the Wagner Group. And we'll look at how the Wagner uprising might affect the Russian leader's travel plans to the BRICS summit in South Africa. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
In times of change, when the world seems uncertain, and what we hear doesn't reflect what we see, we seek the truth. When we are told only part of the story, we lose trust. In moments of crisis, our dreams, hopes, and wishes for a better tomorrow depend on a free press. At Voice of America, we bring you the stories that people take risks to see. We connect the world and unite it with truth. At Voice of America, we show you the whole picture.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
You're watching VOA's Red Carpet. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us each week right here on Red Carpet. We bring you the latest in...
With Straight Talk Africa, welcome back. Friday's mutiny in Moscow has raised questions about the status of the Wagner mercenary group's activities in some African countries. The paramilitary group has long been considered Moscow's armed wing in places like Syria, as well as the Central African Republic, Mali, and several other African countries. Now, they're believed to be actively engaged in conflicts across multiple countries on the continent. So what are the implications of Friday's rebellion for the countries who rely on Wagner's services? Joining me now to discuss this is Sanusha Naidoo. She's a foreign policy analyst with the Institute for Global Dialogue. She joins us from Cape Town, South Africa, and from Monterey in California. We are joined by Paul Nantulia. He's a specialist in Africa at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. Sanusha, Paul, a warm welcome to Straight Talk Africa. And Paul, I'm going to start out with you here. Why is Wagner in Africa? For those people who hear this name now but who might not be familiar, because this group has always presented sort of a shadowy presence on the continent. But what is their footprint like, especially in places in Central and West Africa? Can you give us an idea and also tell us what's in it for the African countries here?
Is that for me?
Yes, it is.
Yes. Okay. No, thank you very much. So the Wagner Group, as you mentioned, is really the spear tip. It's the spear tip of Russia's security and military operations, foreign security and military operations. We've seen this in Syria. We've seen this in Georgia. We saw it in Crimea in 2014. But Africa is really pretty much the center of gravity for Wagner. It has operations in Mali, in Mozambique at some point, in Guinea, Burkina Faso. There's a lot of talk about Burkina Faso, in Sudan. And basically what they do is they provide governments with security packages. They train them. They provide them with surveillance equipment. Secondly, they also wage counterinsurgency operations for these governments. They fight on behalf of these governments, fighting rebel groups. We've seen this in the Central African Republic. And thirdly, they provide, they are an intermediary as far as weapons supplies and supply of military technologies from Russia. This is a big part of Russia's engagements. I think it would be important to recall that Russia's economic engagements are really just a fraction of China's. For instance, China is, you're talking $200 billion a year. Russia's is about $12 billion. But when it comes to arms sales, when it comes to weaponry, Russia is still, even after sanctions, is still the number one supplier on the continent. So Wagner has been a critical element of that, and I don't see this disappearing after this these dramatic events that we saw in Moscow that weekend.
These events were dramatic indeed. Sanusha, South Africa has been making headlines, of course, as we all know, for its ties to Russia. But what exactly is Russia doing in a country like South Africa? I mean, what are the political and economic interests in a country that is seen around the world as a stable democracy?
Good day, Hedy, and good day to Paul. I think in the case of South Africa, you constantly hear the narrative that there's this historical relationship between Moscow and the ruling party, the African National Congress. But I think if we shift it away from the political historical narrative to the economic, it's still a very small actor in our economy. During the years of Jacob Zuma, when he was president, there was this talk about nuclear deals and other kinds of economic activity, but those all kind of became stalemated or they didn't go much further. So I think in the case of South Africa and Russia, I think there's this kind of architecture around a historical narrative. But again, in terms of the fact that South Africa chooses this position around non-alignment, but of course is getting a lot of flak for it in both international and domestic media about how that is interpreted in practice, I think it comes across as if South Africa seems to lean a little bit more towards Russia. But I think in a sense, there's almost a sense of misinterpretation by the South African side and strategic miscalculations and missteps around how to articulate its foreign policy objectives, strategic ambit, and imperatives. And I think the challenge right now is rather the question around the BRICS. And importantly, despite the situation in Moscow and the kind of bizarre mutiny that was aborted over the weekend, there's still in our domestic media questions about whether we have to have a relationship with Russia. I think the challenge now, is, as of today, was the question of whether President Ramaphosa, in his deliberation and conversations and discussions with President Putin, will be discussing the BRICS summit and the attendance of President Putin. It was quite interesting that the president's spokesperson said in his media weekly media briefing today that we are out of South Africa is out of options when it comes to the to President Putin visiting South Africa or attending the BRICS summit rather. But I think this is now almost secondary to what's really happening. The world is fixated and paying a lot of attention to the internal dynamics in Russia and how that's impacting on President Putin's political and domestic power. And I think to my mind and my kind of interpretation is that this is almost a fortuitous moment, and I don't say this in any kind of positive way. It's almost this moment where South Africa could step back and say, well, it's up to President Putin if he wants to decide to travel, because now he's actually sitting with a very, very critical juncture in his domestic politics based on the first part of this interview with the Voice of America correspondent and how this impacts on President Putin, because President Putin has to now decide if he leaves Moscow, what does this mean for his internal dynamics and his the impact that that would have. And I think a lot of the media response, international commentary, narratives are now beginning to ask that question about how vulnerable is President Putin if he stays in Moscow or if he leaves, and how will that impact on him attending the BRICS summit?
Indeed, Sanusha, I was wondering if Pretoria was heaving a collective sigh of relief in a way, in a strange way, when they saw what was happening on television over the weekend. Paul, what does Friday's rebellion and the fact that it was so short-lived mean for Wagner's footprint in Africa? Those presidents and those countries who rely on Wagner, do you sense that there was real panic or there is real concern?
Well, Heidi, I think there are three possible scenarios. But before I go into them, I'll just briefly mention that the privatization of force and the privatization of violence is almost as long as the Russian state itself. From the very beginning, from imperial times, going all the way up to the Soviet Union, the Russian military has always had a relationship with non-state actors that have the heavy backing of the state in foreign military operations. So this is older than Putin, and it is older than the Russian Federation. And the reason I say that is, in my assessment, I think there's going to be a continuation. There are three scenarios. The one scenario is those Wagner forces in Africa could be forced to sign contracts with the Russian government or the Ministry of Defense or the embassies in those countries, and then continue whatever operations they're conducting with those African governments. That's the first scenario. The second scenario is you will have maybe two or three different offshoots of Wagner. One element of Wagner that is loyal to Putin and agrees to come under the control of the Ministry of Defense or some other management structure. Another element that remains loyal to Prigozhin, and perhaps another element that remains loyal. Because remember, Wagner is not the only one. There are other private security outfits of that nature. So whether Prigozhin is there or not, it's going to continue. The third element would be, Russia basically deciding to supply its own forces, its special forces, for instance, to go into those African countries to kind of take over some of the functions that the Wagner group has been conducting. But that one will be very, very difficult because, I mean, Putin clearly has a manpower problem in Ukraine. He has a manpower problem. And as I mentioned before, this privatization of violence is intrinsic to the Russian state. So in any of those scenarios, African countries are actually the losers because Africans frown on mercenary activity. There are African Union conventions against mercenary activity. And there's legislation in many African countries against the use of mercenaries. And mercenary activity is very unpopular on the continent. So it's a critical issue, and it's an issue that touches on democratization and governance.
Indeed, Paul Sanusha, by his own admission, Yevgeny Prigozhin is running large disinformation campaigns across Africa, and that there are parts of the continent where sort of these types of troll farms have found fertile ground. Now, here in the United States, of course, if we'll remember, Yevgeny Prigozhin has been indicted for meddling in the 2016 U.S. election. What about South Africa? Is there fertile ground there ahead of the 2024 election for the resources of the Wagner Group to be used to keep those in power in power?
You know, Haiti, I would say that when you go back to the map that you put up around Wagner activity and you coded it according to recent activity, when I looked at the map, I saw that it was a kind of light shade of orange in terms of what we've been hearing and perhaps picked up in the 2019 election in South Africa, where there was a bit of a presence of Wagner, but not so kind of explicit. That they were here, they were kind of a grouping or a kind of splinter from, I mean, not a splinter, kind of grouping of them that was observing the elections. I think from now to 2024, there's a lot of intense scrutiny on the ruling party. There's a lot of narrative. There's a lot of media reporting, exposing of not just what's happening at the domestic level with the ANC and the governance questions and issues around internal fragmentation, challenges, etc., but also in terms of trips made abroad. For example, when President Ramaphosa had went with the African peace mission. In South African media, it wasn't seen as something that was positive. There was a lot of challenges about the plane that was stopped in Poland that couldn't go on with the security detail, questions of what was in the containers. So I think from now to the next election, I think there's a lot of spotlights that will be shining on the ANC. And even now, with the narrative, I mean, the foreign minister was asked about the mutiny, and she didn't really come across and said, you know, anything about what happened in Moscow over the weekend and the bizarre circumstances around it and the dramatic impact that it had. But I think these are going to be critical issues that are not going to allow for our election to actually come get caught in the crosshairs of what's going on. I think a few years ago, the same thing happened in Madagascar with the group, where they had the similar kind of interference around supporting particular opposition movements, parties, etc., playing the kind of checkbook diplomacy, utilizing that space. I think in South Africa, we have a very, very strong media, a very, very open media, but a very, very a media that's very ready to go to book with the ruling party, and that in itself is going to be something in terms of how we move forward. On Twitter, you have the Twitter trolls, you have people that are basically utilizing the space, both in terms of, particularly I've seen much more of a negative response to South Africa and its relationship with Russia. Every single day in our dailies, whether it's the print or the electronic media, there's at least two or three editorials that are being written about this. So I think at the moment, it's very difficult for us to say that this is going to happen. I think one of the things that's come out is the question of political party funding. That's going to be key. Indeed. In terms of the ANC as well.
Paul Antilio, we don't have a lot of time here. I want to put the last question to you just briefly. Please tell us, what is your assessment of the so-called peace mission that took place a couple of weeks ago? There was a lot of talk about whether it was successful, effective, yes or no. What's your take?
Well, thanks, Heidi, for that question. Sanusha, you know, your points are very well taken. Well, I think it's a mixed bag. I wouldn't really call it a mediation mission. The mission went there to establish facts, to improve on its own analysis of the situation and its own understanding. But I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, you know, clearly the situation in Russia and that part of the world, I think, has driven a point home to the African presidents that this is very, very, it's a very tricky situation. I mean, they were in that area just less than a week before this crisis erupted. One wonders what might have happened if they had still been there on the ground. So I think that's the first element. The second element is, you know, this crisis of grain shipments and fertilizer shipments, that is all thrown into flux, you know, as a result of the upsurge that we saw over the weekend. It just serves as a reminder of the really deterioration of the security situation that we've seen in that part of the world, which is obviously going to have an impact on Africa.
Well, Paul Nontuya, Sanusha Naidoo, thank you so much. You have been fantastic guests. I've learned a lot, and this was a great discussion. I do appreciate your insights and your time. And that is where we will leave it for this week. Thank you so much for watching and for always listening. And thank you to our affiliate stations who bring you Straight Talk Africa every week. Do make sure to follow us on social media, and you can find all your latest news from across the continent on voaafrica.com. I'll see you next time. Until then, it's goodbye.